this podcast is an excerpt of a conversation that I, Eliza Chandler, had with my friend and artist Alex Palmer after we together visited Deirdre Logue's exhibition, admiring all we accomplished at the Tangled Art Gallery on May 25th, 2017.
Well, I'll start with a question I wanted to ask you on the way here. It was about the context of the work. The artist's statement surprised me. So it surprised me because I was expecting it to almost like give me an overall frame to contextualize the three pieces of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very, like, for me, it didn't do that. And I am assuming that was intentional. And I thought that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. It actually didn't make it, let's say, it didn't make it easier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And it's interesting because we talk a lot about that at Tangled, how to translate work.
Yeah.
And if the intention of the work is not to be immediately understood, but instead to sort of create sort of a state of suspended bafflement or an invitation to be confused or an invitation to be disoriented, how do we translate that into an accessible form? So to translate the experience of bafflement might not be to explain what the show's about. But on the other hand, we don't want people to feel as though they're not tapped into the right languages or the right discourses or the right histories, so that their bafflement becomes because they're not the intended audience.
Yes. It's a really important question, and I think it's a very, that question will probably continue to be difficult to answer for a long time, because it did strike me. The piece, I mean, all three pieces, I felt a kinesthetic familiarity in terms of my engagement with all three pieces.
Mm.
I felt my stomach clench.
Mm.
I was holding my breath. My shoulders were kind of pinching. I was confused. And these are experiences, that's a familiar state of being for me. So it felt very familiar. And I really liked it for that. So yeah, no, I mean, that could have been, that exhibit could have been called Sight Loss. There was something, the work demanded a relationship with the body because of how sensory stimulating it was. I thought the translations that David made, the pillows and the vibrations, I think were a key feature in that exhibit.
I think the work is interesting because it translates an experience of embodied difference in a way that isn't achieved by perhaps taking a photograph.
Yeah.
I think the extensions that David created, the pillows, the ramp, the plinth, that's not just about accessibility. We commissioned those extensions to make the show accessible, but what they in fact did was they created a new way to feel how Deirdre experiences the world. And if the intent of the work, which I think it is about sort of not translating in the sense that we now know what it feels to be in her body, but to give us a sense of a different kind of way of experiencing the world, I don't think is achieved as well when we just watch the videos with our eyes and hear the videos with our ears. I think that anxiety of having your back clench up, your shoulders clench when she's biting on the balloon and eventually it pops. For me,
yeah.
I wouldn't have experienced that to nearly as great effect if there wasn't for that vibrating thing that we were sitting on.
That's interesting, you know, because I can't compare to that experience of watching it and, you know, comparing it that way. But from the audio description and listening to that awful sound of the, you know, the rubber going back and forth across the teeth, I mean, it's so unnerving. Now, it's interesting because the description actually tells you before it happens that the balloon will burst.
Oh, really?
Yes. Now, again, I don't... That's a timing thing. The description of the pieces were not timed with the actual pieces themselves. So you were almost getting... I was getting almost like a preview,
right,
of what was going to happen. Again, if that was an artistic choice, then that's an interesting artistic choice. But I have a feeling it probably wasn't an artistic choice.
It was probably clumsiness.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was clumsiness. Yeah. So I think I have to contextualize my experience being one that was given a preview or a kind of, I knew what was going to happen in each piece before it actually happened. And certainly, in the case of that piece, I think that would have been an excellent artistic decision. Because to tell you, the viewer, or the person experiencing it, the listener, that a balloon is going to pop in a woman's face, that instantly made me anxious.
And not only pop, but pop because she's biting it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think it worked for that particular video. The other two installations, I would have wanted the description while it was unfolding. But that aside, getting back to the question about the rubber talk, the vibrations, I thought, demanded that I remain connected to my body while I was experiencing something that I knew was on screen. So when I, as a non-sighted person, when I am watching television or when I'm at an installation that's like a video installation that's being described, I am imagining the images on a screen. I'm not just sort of randomly thinking of them in my head. I'm actually having that experience. I'm imagining that experience of watching a screen with images. And what the vibrations did for me was I wasn't just focusing on what was out there on a screen. I was actually very much aware of what was going on in my body. And I think that was really cool. That's the one where I really felt this is very much how I feel in my own body when I just wander around the city. If I hadn't known anything about the artist, I would have assumed this was possibly a blind artist, an artist who was losing their sight. It had some uncanny connections to the very first piece of video art that I made when I was first losing my sight. And what my work didn't have was that sensory, tactile vibration element to it. And if it had, I think it would have been just such a fuller experience. But yeah, it really could have been about sight loss. But you know, the images were coming and going. Like you couldn't hang on, that's the other thing I noticed about her work. You couldn't hang on to, she didn't allow the viewer to hang on to anything. And also her images, like in Baby Lint Brush, the images just would appear and then you'd be onto a different image and then it would be a pillow, then it would be a lint brush, then it would be a woman lying down, then it would be something, then it was the foot, you know? there was no, it was like nothing lasted very long. So there was this kind of sense that, and again, that to me is a very, that's disability. That's an experience of disability. There is something very particular, I think, in the aesthetic about how the control over the art that you're making is transcending on some level that vulnerability and that lack of control. It's this momentary experience of controlling the uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And it is so it's so elusive. It's so temporary. But that sense that for this small moment in time, you can use the camera to contain what is otherwise uncontainable. And there is, again, I really felt that in that work. I really did. I think the one that really spoke to me in that sense was Big Agnes. There's something so sort of controlled and comforting about a tent, but everything that was being perceived outside of that tent was chaos. So, yeah, it's I do relate to what you this idea of controlled and uncontrollable. And do you think other people? Do you think, getting back to the original question, like, if you don't have that lived experience, does work like this make any sense? And is that okay if it doesn't? Like, again, back to the bafflement.
I mean, I don't know, right? Like, this is my interpretation of Deirdre's work, and I've spoken to her about it a lot, and, you know, and she's always very interested to hear how I relate to the work and how I'm sort of seeing a queer aesthetic in the midst of her queer aesthetic. And as you know, she's the most generous person in the world, but she's not going to say, yes, you've got it. That's exactly my experience of the world and my intention for the artwork. So I don't know if how others respond. You know, I don't think the success of the show lies within somebody understanding that as a moment of controlled vulnerability.
Right.
And I think that if you haven't had that experience as one of your own, then perhaps you don't get that. Perhaps that doesn't come through in the work, because as you say, it's certainly not framed in that way in the artist statement. The artist statement is quite technical. It talks about how Deirdre and David Beauvais work together to create these vibro-tactile videos, but it's not giving you any insight.
No.
So you're left baffled.
Yeah.
And the thing that I love about disability art and seeing your plays and watching you on the cover, you know, when you did the Crip Cabaret about this time last year, was to get the work. You had to understand something about disability. There's some sort of insider knowledge that's going on. You know, and I think it's a particular experience to going into art galleries. Will they have thought about me before I arrived?
And you know, I think going into the Tangled Gallery also has a very unique, it has a totally unique tone, because I walk into that gallery knowing that I have been imagined. I walk into that gallery feeling invited and included and welcome. And I don't walk into any other art gallery or like hardly any other cultural space with that. So that's interesting. There's a comfort that is offered in that gallery that I don't get. Like, let's just imagine that exhibition not in the Tangled Art Gallery.
Well, it was in two other galleries.
Okay, that's interesting.
And they didn't have audio description.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have vibrating extensions.
Oh, wow. I honestly can't imagine that work without those two elements.
Me neither. I really can't. And Deirdre has said she won't show that work again without those two component.
That's brilliant. Those two components are, it's, they don't clarify the work. They enhance the work.
Mm-hmm.
They deepen the work. They speak to the work. It's different than clarifying it. And it's not a translation either. I actually didn't feel like it was being translated. That's not what it felt like.
No.
It felt like there were three different parts to the work. There was the work, the language associated describing the work,
yeah,
and the vibrations,
yeah,
inspired by the work.
Did you like having the artist giving you the audio description?
Totally.
And you know her, so it's likely a different experience. It's a familiar voice. But I really, yeah, like that too.
I love it. You know, and it crossed my mind at one point. I thought, this is Deirdre's voice. And she's, you know, the tone of her voice was very grounded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't emotive, it wasn't... And I just thought, would somebody who wasn't the artist, well, they would have had a different tone of voice.
Mm-hmm.
It made it more authentic.
Amanda Kasha, who's a disability curator in the States, she talks about the ideal being that you would have several different audio descriptions. So one written by an audio describer, one written by a blind person, one written by the artist, one written by the curator, one written by a kid. To sort of mess up this idea that there is one way to describe or translate a video or a visual work into an oral experience.
That's interesting. I'm of two minds.
Yeah.
I like that idea because if it was a translation, if the audio description was intended to be purely a translation of the work so that I, a non-sighted person, would have the best sort of opportunity to engage with the work, therefore let's give lots of different angles and perspectives on the work. However, in this case, I don't think I would have wanted that. I only wanted Deirdre, like, because it didn't, like I say, it didn't actually feel so much as a translation as part of the artist's work itself.
Yeah.
So by giving her that voice, and isolating it more as her voice and not multiple voices, it became part of the artist's work. This whole idea of like the question between, you know, is the experience the most enriched by multiple describers,
mm-hmm,
or is the experience most enriched by the artist's input into the description? They just seem like two different things to me. One seems to be more about the art and the artistic expression, and the other seems like a translation.
I've also heard people, blind artist friends, say that they're not really interested in work that's not intended for a non-visual audience.
Right.
So the experience of having a visual work translated into an oral description,
yes,
is not an experience that they're interested in because, as they say, they're sort of a secondary audience, or, you know, it's not,
yes,
intended for them. They're only interested in work that's tactile or sort of intended for not. The primary way to engage that work, Not being through sight, but being through another experience.
Okay.
I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think that there is something creatively exciting about listening to an audio description in a gallery, or should it always be supplemented by another way of experiencing the work through touch, vibration, performance.
Oh, okay. Gosh, you know, I think it sort of depends on the work itself. Because I'm not convinced that all visual art will maintain its integrity with a tactile experience.
Mm.
You know, for example, like, because, okay, so a I mean, I love, I enjoy having tactile and description. I do. It certainly gives more insight to the piece. But if the piece is about alienation or about distancing yourself from the world, touching something is an incredibly intimate experience. So that might actually just be totally counter to what the piece of art is trying to communicate. You know, I think that's maybe why I was sort of pondering this idea of multiple voices as well, because multiple voices is communicating something. Like, I think every piece of art, in my mind, has its own journey towards the audiences that will come and engage with it. Every piece of art requires a different journey, you know, to that audience. So yeah, I think it would depend on the art itself. But in this case, I can't imagine that work without those added elements. And I would love to, if she ever does it again, I would love to really think more about how the language element of the piece, which we're calling audio description, works more in terms of the timing of it. Like I say, I love the fact that I knew the balloon was going to break ahead of time. But in the other two pieces, I really wanted them timed.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always interested in how audio description can be something to creatively engage with unto itself, so that it's not simply, because it can't be. I mean, it can't, I don't think that it can, that an audio description can, with entire accuracy, translate how I experience something visually. Mm-mm. And how, you know, we've talked about that before. Mm-mm. So the only possibility is that it becomes something new. When it becomes something new, then we can think about not having a headset, which I fumble around and try to get the timing right.
Yeah.
But we actually build it into the experience of the show.
Yes.
So that you're not experiencing the show without the audio description.
Yes. Especially for a piece of work like this. It needed to be embedded. You know, I know that that wasn't Deirdre's intention in the beginning, but like you say, she doesn't want to do it again without it. It so wants to be embedded in the art itself as part of the artist's consciousness, you know, as part of the artistic expression. It just doesn't, it isn't a translation of this work. It is the work itself. And yeah, by going to the desk and picking it up and fumbling around, it unfortunately doesn't actually feel like the work itself, but I think it is the work itself. Audio description is always, I suppose, or is often considered giving access. But, you know, access, as you know, and I think we've talked about, access in itself is suggests that something exists first.
Yeah.
And then you have to find a way,
yes,
you know, to get to it. Whereas if we think about descriptive language more as part of the artistic experience, I think that will change the way blind people engage with visual art. It will be a much better experience. I would agree that there are simply some things that just, to have them described, you're just, you know, like, I saw a circus performance recently. It's just not the same when somebody says, he's juggling three balls, you know, or he's juggling three pins. Yeah. And you're like, right? But there could be, you know, there are better ways of making that visual experience engaging for a non-sighted audience. And I don't think words in that particular case are the way to do it. And maybe the other issue too is that language is a code that we all agree to, whereas a video installation or visual art, it is not so much of a tight code.
Mm-hmm.
Language tends to pin things down.
It really
down.
Does, yeah. Yeah, and it can give us a false sense of translation.
Yeah, which is probably why this idea of like five different describers, you know, is considered an interesting approach.
But, you know, there's something, too, about the experience of going into a gallery.
Yeah.
As being one that's social and interactive and celebratory, especially at an opening.
Yeah.
And, you know, flexible. You start experiencing work. You get interrupted by a conversation. You go back to that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that experience is properly translated when I'm giving you a headset.
No.
And I'm fumbling around and we have to move quickly so we don't miss the beginning.
Yep.
In a way that if it was built into the show, as yep. you're suggesting,
yep.
then that flexibility, social interaction would be possible.
I can't imagine trying to experience that show with other people in the room interrupting
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't happen. In fact, I have to confess, I so wanted to come to the opening because I just adore Deirdre, and I decided not to because I was concerned that it would be a half-baked experience, and I can't bear having conversations with artists who I so respect without really properly being able to, like, talk about their work. And so I decided not to come, and I thought, well, I'll go. And then, of course, you came along, which was great. But, no, I definitely did not... It does not feel like a social... Like, it could be a social experience. However, if I was to go over to the piece either with putting headphones on that are connected into the screens, you know, and coming on as soon as the screens come on, then that would be much more possible for me to interact.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the language was simply like heard by everybody, in which case then everybody's getting that experience.
It's great. Not everyone.
Oh no, of course not, because not everybody can hear it.
Any final thoughts about that show or anything we've been talking about at all?
Well, I feel inspired. I admire this kind of work. In theater, you know, I think so often we spend so much time trying to make sure that it makes sense to the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm so bored of that. I really am. You know, maybe bored isn't the right word. It just doesn't speak to my experience of life. You know, I've been confused about my own area of expertise because it's not expressing my life experience.
Mm.
And I'm searching for a new kind of art form or art expression that is right for me. I don't know, right doesn't seem like the right word, but it definitely theater is not doing it for me.
Mm.
And seeing that show made me feel that there is an artistic expression. There are ways that can express the sorts of ideas that I have. And so for that, I just feel really inspired. So thank you.